Greetings, friends. This is Dr. Mark Sharona, and I want to welcome you to The Edge podcast, where all things theological, psychological, spiritual, and cultural will be explored so that you and I might understand the times and know what to do about them. Enjoy. I want to welcome everyone to the podcast that we're sharing today. I'm delighted to have with me Lisa Fields, the founder of the Jew 3 Project, a Christian apologeticist who, in my estimation, is an emerging voice in the kingdom of God and someone we want to attune our ear to listen to. Lisa, I'm delighted that you're with us today.
Thank you. I want to first thank you for inviting me, Pastor Sharona. It's been a delight to meet you over these last couple years, so thank you.
Well, bless you. For those that might not know all that you're involved with and all that you do, give us a little bit of your history. You're a pastor's daughter. There's a lot of rich history there, but then tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, as you stated, I'm a PK. I don't have the horror stories that many PKs have, but some of my friends do. So I've grown up in church all my life. I was actually born on a Sunday. So my dad used to be the minister of music at Philippian Community Church under the late Lawrence Callahan.
Yeah. And
if you're from Florida, so you know Bishop Callahan.
Yeah, for sure.
And so he was the minister of music there, and I was born on a Sunday, so Bishop Callahan was really strict. So he got off the organ to come during the delivery. He was there, got to see me, and then went right back to church because church lasted for like 4 to 5 hours. in the old days of Pentecostalism, that we were in church all day. And so I was born on a Sunday, in church all my life, never questioned my faith, kind of grew up in a Christian bubble until I got to college. And I was like, I'm going to take a New Testament course and it should be easy. My parents taught me the Bible. You're always looking for an easy elective in college. And it was at the University of North Florida, and nobody told me that religion at a university was different than religion in Sunday school. And so my first day of class, my professor said, I'm going to change everything you thought you knew about Jesus. And at that moment from her tone, I knew that it was going to be a challenge. And that was the first time I critically thought about why I believe what I believe and kind of had a crisis of faith. And my dad introduced me to Ravi Zacharias' videos, start watching that, and developed a love and passion for apologetics, but realized there weren't many Black people in the space and wanted to bridge the gap. And ended up graduating with my degree in public relations and religious studies from UNF, going into banking, and then going off to seminary to get my Master's of Divinity and starting Jude 3 my last year of seminary.
Wow, amazing. And, you know, I was thinking about Bishop Callahan because back in the day when I was blowing and going, Bishop had me come up and preach for him way back. But it's kind of dating me. But when you made the decision to move from a career in banking and stock brokering to apologetics, talk a little bit about that. And obviously Ravi was seminal in that decision making. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about that from your perspective, your own cultural perspective.
Yeah, I never would have thought I'd be here today because I grew up a PK. I used to tell my parents, once I get out into the real world, I'm moving to New York City, working on Wall Street. I'm never going to be in a ministry. I'm going to a big church and sit in the back and not do anything. Because when you're a PK, you understand that ministry can be all-consuming. And so, but it was that crisis of faith, knowing like other people are having this experience. Other African-American youth are having these experiences. And it's not always like the whole apologetics is not always boosted up or talked about in the African-American context. And as we get more exposure and more educated as a people, these questions are coming up. And there needs to be someone to answer those questions. And I was reluctant to the call because I felt like I wasn't necessarily good enough to do it or lead a movement. I'm friends with Bishop Vaughn McLaughlin here, And he was one of the people that was like, you need to go to seminary, you need to go to seminary. And I actually wanted him to start G3. I remember I sending him emails like, Bishop, this is needed. I know you like apologetics too. You should start this. You should start a website. And that's the one email he never responded to.
I can just hear him not responding.
And so I think that was God pushing me, like, you don't, this is your call. Don't try to push it off on someone else.
So that's So talk to me a little bit, Lisa, about apologetics in the Black community and why it's so important foundationally, and why right now for you it's a major issue.
Yeah, apologetics, I think most people don't know what it is. My grandmother for a long time thought I said I'm sorry for a living. So and it comes from the Greek word apologia, which Peter references in 1 Peter 3:15, we ought to give a defense for the faith. And so when we talk about classical apologetics, usually it's about proving the existence of God. Well, in the African-American context, most Black people believe that God exists. But the question then becomes, where is God in the midst of the suffering and injustices of the world? So they turn to other people who may give answers to that, like Hebrew Israelism, Nation of Islam, Five Percenters, because it gives them an answer to something that I felt like historically cultural apologetics was missing. And so there needed to be something to understand the context and the questions we're dealing with. So it's not that classical apologetics is not helpful. It's just not relevant all the time to the context. So pastors are looking like, oh, that's great, you know, that you have this cultural, this apologetic from the existence of God. But the people that are doubting in my context already believe in God. So it's not gonna connect for them.
Okay, and I hear that. It's very significant. So when you think about the need for an apologetic for the Black community, and I totally concur. Where do you think the disconnect is when someone that is part of the dominant culture either can't understand that or wants to deflect and move away from that theologically?
I think the history of Christianity in America and the ways in which it was used and abused to further oppress Africans during slavery, and using scriptures like slaves submit to your masters as a way to keep slaves docile and to a way to manipulate them into the majority culture's agenda. So the ignorance, I think, of that history kind of reinforces this narrative that the history has reinforced the narrative that Christianity is a white man's religion, which is one of the major questions that we deal with at the Jude 3 Project. We have an HBCU tour, historically Black churches, not churches, historically Black colleges and universities, in which we have forums on these college campuses to let them know, like, Christianity isn't a white man's religion. But we also want to be able to connect with them and let them know that we understand why they would think that. But just because something has been manipulated doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that anything can be misused.
I remember back in 1978 or 79 when Walter Brueggemann wrote his classic book, Prophetic Imagination, amongst many others. One of the things he addresses in there is that as we look at history from a biblical perspective in America, we have been taught official history while real history has been covered up. And you're alluding to that in some of what you're saying. And would you be willing to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah. I love that it's that our history has been covered up, because most people, when they see Jesus, they see the pictures of the white man with blonde hair, blue eyes. It was interesting. I just had a conversation with two young gentlemen that identify spiritual, not religious, which is the trendy thing to say now. And one of the guys said that his challenge with Christianity was that it makes you believe that Black people are only, they only exist because of the curse. And I was like, well, what do you mean by that? He said, because, not because of the curse, because of the fall. I'm sorry. I said, well, what do you mean by that? He was like, Adam and Eve were white. And so that means that Black people wouldn't exist if they hadn't have ate fruit. And so I'm like, well, what, why do you think they're white? He's like, the pictures. And so the what that does to the mind, to see white images and to, for them, people to internalize that and say, I reject Christianity because it's telling me that the, that my whole existence comes from the failure of humanity.
When in actual fact, the reverse is the truth, because Africa is the cradle of civilization. So Adam and Eve were not light complected, they were dark complected. And all of us came from one blood. So the reality is, there needs to be a real a wake-up call in some circles, not all, but some people are aware of this, but it's deeply troubling to me at this season of my life to realize that so many are not aware of these things. Here you are, you have now, you're at this journey where you're on a trajectory towards making an impact. In light of what's going on right now with the unrest, what do you see are the signs of, if any, of hope in the midst of the unrest?
So I think more people are listening, and they're moving from listening to lamenting. And they're like, their eyes, it's like their eyes are opened. Like when Adam and Eve ate the fruit and said that their eyes are open. It is like them seeing videos, their eyes are open. I think with the George Floyd thing and the Ahmaud Arbery, but especially in George Floyd, the fact that he held his knee on his neck for almost 9 minutes, you can't watch that and not have some kind of empathy.
Although some don't. It's mind-boggling, but some don't.
Yeah, and that's the disheartening part, that some don't. But I think the majority of people, it's like, okay, I see what they were saying now. It's starting to make sense.
Yeah.
And so, especially when it's just for a suspected counterfeit $20 bill. Right. that just, it doesn't make sense. And so, I'm hopeful that people are starting to wake up to that reality. I hope, though, that it will move from just lament to legislation. Okay. That we say, we need to put some laws in place. As Martin Luther King said, the law can't make a man love me, but it can keep me from, it can keep him from lynching me. And that's important.
Absolutely. Yeah. The idea that morality can't be legislated is an old argument, and certainly God can change the heart, but Paul clearly talks about the need for law in civil society. And there are some theological articles that have been done on challenging the idea that you can't legislate morality. So that the fact that you quoted Dr. King, I mean, that's a profound reality. So when we think about actionable steps, talk a little bit from your perspective in your generation about moving from lament to actionable steps. What do you see are the things that need to be done that we all need to participate in?
So I think understanding what we really want. I think there's a movement where it's like everybody's crying out. And then when people are saying, well, what do you want? It's still like, I'm crying out. It's not like a unified, clear, actionable steps from everybody, which is fine because people are really still wrestling with the moment. So you're not going to, everything is not going to be thought out in that moment. So I think as we begin to progress and continue to move forward, we need to think about what do we really want and what is actually going to be hopeful for us as a society moving forward. So I think one of the things is also, once we figure out what we really want, is understanding who could get that for us. So when we think about criminal justice legislation, sometimes we put all the weight on federal, when actually most of the things that are going to impact our local police is going to be local elections that we talk to city council, the mayor about, or state level with state prisons. So understanding the right avenues to go through, I think, is very crucial. So we need to educate on ourselves on how the system actually works. Because protesting is going to move some things swiftly and let some legislation up on the docket. But as a system, we have to just get more involved. And I think local churches have to get more involved in our local politics and encourage people to vote for our attorney generals, to know who the judges are, not just kind of most people cherry pick. I mean, they just go.
Very true. Very true.
In the election, and the only person they pay attention to is the president or the congressman or the senator, if that. And so everything else is like, I can be voting in the worst person in the world for this job with the worst record, but I just haven't educated myself on it. And I think faulty systems thrive on the ignorance of society.
That is profound.
We have to educate ourselves to know who to vote for and not just rally around the president, because the president has power, but not on the local level like we always think.
It's interesting because, you know, growing up in the era I grew up in, we were taught all politics is local. Mm-hmm. And there's a profound truth to that. If someone were to ask you, as an African-American woman, Lisa, when a Caucasian person reacts to the term white privilege or white supremacy, from an apologetic perspective, given that I'm sure you've had to tangle with that before, and from someone who really has argued and taken hits as well, how would you respond? And what would you say to help inform them of those realities?
So when we think of, especially the term as that people think is loaded like white privilege, I always like to start with my own privilege. So I'm an African-American woman that grew up in a two-parent home in a middle-class neighborhood. So there's a certain level of privilege that I might have over an African-American woman that grew up in a
single-parent
home and in poverty, right? So because I have a step ahead, in a sense, just because my family dynamic, I use the tools I have at my disposal to help those who didn't have those same privileges as I. And so then I go and say, hey, so as a white person, systemically, you have more privileges just because of your skin complexion. It may not be your socioeconomic status, but it's proven statistically that white people with uneducated can get a job faster than black educated people. So that's a level of privilege, and you just steward it for those who don't have that level of privilege. I find that more helpful to start with my privilege because it disarms. I think people, if you just go at them with saying you have white privilege, then the walls go up because there's so many things that come along with that statement that they've heard. And they think, okay, if you say I have white privilege, that they've put it with racism. So they think, so they're fighting against things that they've conflated with the term.
Right.
And so I think disarming and starting with my own privilege has helped me in conversations when I talk about white privilege.
Profound. And deeply wise. When we started our church in Raleigh, North Carolina, so, I mean, born and raised in New York, eventually moved to Pittsburgh with Bishop Garlington. When we went down to Raleigh, North Carolina in the late 1980s to pioneer the work there, we specifically went with the intent of bridging the racial divide, not realizing how different it was in the South, where the mindset was a little different, obviously, than in the North. And discovering, here we were in Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Riso Triangle Park, the most desirable recession-proof place in America at the time. May still be, I don't know. And the majority of, at the time, the data was clear, the majority of those that were well-educated for upper and middle management were the African-Americans, while most of the Caucasian-Americans were less qualified for those upper and middle management positions, and yet they were the ones that were hired, to the exclusion of the African-Americans that were there. And that was that, seeing that as as someone that was not even aware that those kind of things were realities. And I'm sure they're in the North as well. I'm just, at the time, I'm sure they were, but I wasn't aware. It opened my awareness. It began a painful journey towards waking up. And so when you look at the contrast between your generation and my generation, and I'm sure you have, how do you evaluate where we're going and how we kind of find a way there so that we're all on the same page, if that makes sense?
So I think we don't find a way to a better reality without each other. I think we, like the Bible says, I call the young because they're strong, the older because they're wise. I think we need the passion and the and the zeal of my generation.
Absolutely.
But we also need the wisdom of the baby boomers to help us not recreate the wheel and not try to do things that aren't going to actually work or create change. I think sometimes we're ignorant of the history and the work that's gone before us. So every generation thinks they're doing something new. Within the 60s, your generation was doing the same thing, but in just different ways. So they know, like, there's a way that this is helpful, but we had some pitfalls along the way that you can avoid by doing it this way. And my hope is that the generations will come together and use that wisdom and that strength for progress, because I don't see it's really making tangible inroads without each other.
And is Jude 3 obviously part of it?
Yeah. I love to try to bridge the gap with bringing younger and older scholars together, highlighting. I did a conversation with one of my mentors, Dr. Cynthia James, recently. Yes. And one of the reasons I love talking to Dr. James is because there are some things that I become frantic about, and talking to her calms me because she's lived life and she's like, well, that's not really that important, you know? And I think those kinds of relationships help you navigate life to be better.
So as we move to wrap things up, what are some things for you that we haven't covered that you would like to share that are on your heart? What are some of the other things that for you are significant and important? Just take your time and just talk to it.
I think what's on my heart right now is, because I just had that conversation with those young guys, is to, for the older generation, is to really listen to the younger generation, listen to their frustrations, listen to their questions, and don't dismiss them. I think the older generation would make more inroads with the younger generation by just listening without the defenses up. And that, I think that goes even in the race conversations when we have, well, I always tell my white brothers and sisters, don't get defensive. Sometimes people just want to, they just want to vent. They're not accusing you of anything, but they have so much pent up stuff and frustration that they just need to get it out. And if you just let them get it out, then at some point they'll get to the place where they feel like, okay, you're a safe person. And so I think that listening component is going to be the greatest help in our building bridges across generational divides, around racial divides, I think it's going to be extremely, extremely important.
Profound, very wise. What are some of the mechanisms you've put in place for events or for conversations that those of us that might say, Lisa, we'd love to be a part, we want to lend a listening ear, we want to be part of the conversation, what can we do?
Yeah, so we have this thing called Courageous Conversations, where I bring together the leading scholars in the African American space on conservative and progressive backgrounds to perform, to have what we call courageous conversations, because apologetics is known for debates. That's why a lot of pastors don't like it, because they're like, I don't want that argument in my church. I don't want those questions. And I think we need to reframe it, because I think arguing with people doesn't always help. You know, the Bible says he that wins souls is wise. And I think a wiser way of getting people to see your view is through conversation, not debate. And so I think how I would instruct people to engage people who have different views is going back to the listening, and also always think this is a conversation. I'm not trying to beat you. I'm not trying to defeat you. I'm trying to hear you. I'm trying to learn. And I'm trying to win you. So I think when we move from trying to win a debate to win a soul, it shifts us in our posture.
So if people, Lisa, want to get in touch with you, how can they get in touch with you?
They can do so going to Jude3Project.org, hitting the contact, or you can find us on social at Jude3Project on all social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Well, Lisa, I applaud what you're doing. I'm deeply impacted. I'm excited for you, and you've renewed my hope for the future. I deeply value your wisdom and who you are as a person, and I want to be part of the conversation. So I will continue to ask you questions because I want to listen.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for your support of the Jude3 Project. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, bless you. And folk, we will have another podcast coming up real soon, but make sure that when you listen to this podcast that you share it with as many of your friends as possible. It's life-changing. God bless you all.